You're listening to episode 20 of season 6 of the GNU World Order. Everyone, this is Klaatu, your host of the GNU World Order. The GNU World Order is, of course, a GNU Linux ogcast about all things technical and geeky. This episode is the season finale, meaning pretty much that I've done 20 episodes in, since the fifth season, so I've arbitrarily assigned each season to have 20 episodes. Next season, however, I may, and this is not completely decided upon yet, but I might try 24 episodes in the season. The reason being because it feels like if I could make it a consistently fortnightly podcast, then that might be a good idea. That might be kind of nice for the listeners to know that there's going to be an episode, you know, every 2 weeks, rather than there being lots of episodes and then there being a month or 2 month gap, and then there being lots of episodes and then there being a month gap, and then there being a consistent number of episodes. You know, it's just kind of, that's not how one really wants to run a show, even though that is actually how I've run my show for a good 6 seasons now. But anyway, I'm thinking about trying more of like a twice monthly kind of schedule and see if that works. And it might. I'm starting to settle into the new job and kind of settle into things in general, so it could work. I'm not making any promises, though, but it is something that I'm looking into. So we might try that. This episode being the season finale, I'm just going to throw in everything. If I haven't talked about it yet, then I'm going to talk about it this time. And if I have talked about it before, I'll probably talk about it again if I feel like it. So there's no time limit on this episode. I've taken to doing my season finales as double episodes, sort of tributes to Stank Dog from BinRev, Hacker Public Radio. His big last BinRev Radio last episode was like 7 hours long or something. I don't think I can stretch this one out quite that long, but I'm going to allow myself a little bit more freedom and meandering. Speaking of freedom and meandering, this just in. GNOME 3 out OS 10's OS 10. Yes, I haven't really talked a whole lot about GNOME 3. I'm going to talk about it a little bit, and that's proportionate to how much experience I have with it. I'm not using it actively, but I did, we at the place that I work got a computer, and this computer was purchased after the OS 10 Lion release. OS 10 Lion being, of course, 10.7 Mac OS. It was released, they bought a computer, so it happened to come with Lion on it. It wasn't like they needed that for anything, it happened to be the latest, greatest OS version. So I got a chance to play with OS 10 Lion as I was setting up the computer for the user that was going to be using it on an everyday basis. And aside from the initial unsettling shocks, like when I would see just little touches here and there that were just oddly reminiscent of GNOME 3 or KWin, certain KWin effects, or even something like color schemes and even design themes that were very Ubuntu-ish. There were like really little touches, weird little things that would happen that I would think, I've seen that before, or you know, kind of like I'd look at something and just think, I'm not using GNOME right now, am I? And of course I wasn't. I was using Finder. There were some moments there. But aside from those moments, I found myself, in general, thinking how underwhelming OS 10 Lion was. And how when one thinks of Mac OS, what is one really saying? Now, me, personally, having come from Mac platform, when I said Mac OS, and I say said past tense because it has actually changed, when I used to say it, I was speaking very specifically of certain things in the OS that I was accustomed to. Certain keyboard shortcuts, certain conventions of getting one file from here to there, or of opening an application and having it remain open until I explicitly quit it rather than just whenever I close the windows. Little things like that. That's what I meant when I would say OS X. And I remember very, very clearly, actually, that my friend 330 in IRC once told me, oh, GNOME is more like OS X, and KDE is more like Windows. And I thought, wow, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about, because GNOME is nothing like OS X. And yet now, strangely, that I've gotten a lot of distance from OS X, and I really don't identify with OS X anymore on any level. I used to very much identify with it. You know, everything that I did back on OS X was normal computing to me, and now it's not. It's abnormal computing to me. I mean, I still like some of the conventions, my keyboard shortcuts, my lack of menus on my applications, things like that. But all in all, there's no identification there. There's no expectation, certainly. So the farther removed I come from it, I realize that there is kind of a generic usage of the idea of OS X. There's a conceptual generification of that term. When you think of it, it's a simple interface. It is a, I say, restrictive interface, although in a way that can be good. That's the classic argument, right? I mean, if there's only one way to do something, then people get it pounded into them, and so they think, okay, that's how I do this function. I take issue with that idea, but that is something that people talk about. So if that is OS X, then it's obviously not OS X, but it's the idea of simplified, very kind of sparse interfaces without a whole lot of options and without a whole lot of configuration or configurability. This sounds horrible to me, actually. I mean, I'm trying to say it really nicely and like it's a feature, but it's really difficult to say. But I mean, that's fair, right? I mean, if you're saying there are two different ways that you can present an interface for your audience, then that would be an option. That would be one way to do it. And so if we just say, okay, OS X is that it's a generic thing that represents the idea of a fairly minimal, sparsely populated kind of little interface that lets you just do really the basics, then that's OS X. And if you think about it in that way, and you sit in front of GNOME 3, and someone says to you, hey, a new OS X has just been released, and you look at GNOME 3, I would argue that those two things sort of merge and become one, and it becomes very much one in a sort of perfect, concentric, kind of holistic circle, meaning that GNOME 3 does it really, really well. And again, I'm not speaking of your productivity. I'm not speaking of Linus Torvalds' productivity, and I'm sorry for all those GNOME 2 users who lost their desktop, I really am, but in terms of just being an outsider who's not going to use GNOME either way, or OS X for that matter, if we're talking about beautiful, beautifully designed, really attractive, really smooth, and just kind of addictively fun to use and easy to use, and kind of like you can sense the design, GNOME 3 pwns Lion. I honestly very tempted to try to set up GNOME 3 on a computer here at my workplace and sit someone in front of it and tell them that it is OS Lion and see what they say. Because I'll bet you anything they will just love it and say that it's gorgeous and go crazy over it. Because, well, actually here I know they would, because they don't even notice when they're using GNOME 2 as opposed to OS X. But even so, I mean, I really think that I think that would be a fun experiment, because, and I think I remember some people doing that with KDE and saying that that was Windows 7 or something, and people like raving about it. So it's not an original idea by any means. But really, like, after, it was just weird timing that GNOME 3 came out relatively close, at least to me, because it was Fedora 15 really that was the thing that I used it on for real. So when that came out, and then it must have only been like a month later that OS X came, X Lion came out. Using the two fairly closely together like that, I found myself wishing that GNOME 3 was Lion, or vice versa. You know, I kind of thought I really had expected somehow more from that big monolith in California, and we didn't. It didn't really happen. Which is really interesting. I don't know why that happened. or didn't happen, rather. But it's an interesting thing to note. In terms of the accusations and stuff that, I mean, certainly I've read it online, that Lion, quote-unquote, rips off Ubuntu and things like that, there were a lot of little elements in Lion that you will look at, and it doesn't even take a whole lot of imagination to see the connection between what they're doing in Lion and the stuff that is happening on the Linux desktop. And it's not just Ubuntu, it's not just GNOME 3, it's a lot of things. It's Kwin, it's Qt, it's GNOME 3, it's Unity, it's Ubuntu. There's lots of little touches here and there. Things just from the polish of the interface. And I know people traditionally say that OS X is such a polished entity, but I've never seen it like that. As long as I can remember, OS X has been a very strange patchwork of last revision's design plus this revision's design. In this version, they've finally actually seemed to smooth a lot of that stuff out. They've gotten rid of those ugly, gooey, aqualicious blue scroll bars that they've just had since, like, 10.1 for some reason, even though they've been on the whole sort of muted, non-brushed, brushed metal look for 3 or 4 versions now. So it's just been, like, really weird kinds of, like, oh, quick, let's use these really gaudy sort of 1990s looking jewels for our closing, you know, close the window buttons, and use these weird candy aqua scroll bars and buttons, but these muted gray windows. It's really strange hodgepodge of design elements. I never could understand why people kept insisting that it was a polished interface. And then the way they couldn't decide between the smoky black transparent glass that the dock would become on the side versus the over-glossy 3D shelf on the bottom. It's really, really not very unified. I've always thought that. And they've fixed that, but they've done silly little things that Linux has had for ages, and probably Windows too. Things like being able to resize a window from all corners and all edges of the window rather than just from one solitary edge down at the bottom. Believe it or not, on Mac, for as long as Mac has existed, you've never been able to adjust windows from all edges and corners, at least not that I can recall, and certainly not in OS X. So that was a big innovation. The fact that you can right-click on the desktop and change desktop wallpaper just with a right-click, it's pretty amazing. And a lot of the little animations, windows zoom fading in, even after, like, login and stuff like that. It's a dead ringer for a Compiz or a Kwin effect. If you see it, you will for a moment think that you are using Compiz or Kwin. You will not, your brain will not understand how you are not using one of those. It's a really weird sensation. Maybe this is old news to some of you who have been around for a long time. Maybe those of you who saw when OS X ripped off the cube effect, or those of you who saw when OS X stole the virtual desktops. I mean, I saw that, but I was barely using Linux at that time, or it was just around that time. So maybe this is old hat to you. To me, it basically looks like OS X got a really good makeover. I shouldn't say really good. I should say a very complete makeover. I mean, they actually unified the design to a large extent, and they put in a lot of practical little features that Linux and again probably Windows have had just for ages, and good for them, darn it. But in terms of wanting something exciting and brand new and glossy and shiny and smooth and addictive and interesting and thinking outside of the box and all of that good stuff, there they did not deliver. That wasn't something that they were able to achieve this time. But GNOME 3, in stark contrast, absolutely did. And KDE 4, of course, has had it ever since KDE 4.0, but hey, I digress. But yeah, really interesting developments. Of course, OS X, quote-unquote, ripping off Linux or Ubuntu or whatever, it's almost, that kind of accusation or that kind of idea almost misses the point. Because, I mean, if you think about the way that things happen in this world, not just in programming, not just in design, but really everything, there is a sense of where things are going. You know, things, individuals and different projects move in the same direction. They kind of feed off of each other. So yeah, maybe Ubuntu borrowed stuff from iOS, maybe iOS borrowed stuff from something before it, and maybe OS X borrowed stuff from Ubuntu now, and not just Ubuntu, but like GNOME 3 and KWin, well, KDE, but specifically a lot of those KWin effects that just seem to have just appeared in OS X all of a sudden. So yeah, I'll stop short of saying that they ripped or plagiarized. I'll just say that they fed off of the environment. And that's, I don't think that's uncommon. What isn't beside the point, and what is maybe uncommon but should be a lot more common, is attribution. I think there's a tendency in the free software world for people to kind of naturally cite what inspired them to add a feature. You know, if someone adds a dock, or comes up with a dock plasmoid or something, they say, oh, I've made this dock, and it acts a lot like the OS X dock, blah, blah, blah. Or, I made this little applet for the system tray, and it acts a lot like the Windows 7 thing, you know? And it becomes, it's always this simile. This is like this other thing from either Apple or Windows. And that it's honest, that's the honest statement, because that's, they're telling the truth. That's where they got the idea, that's what inspired them, whatever. Apple, Microsoft, other places, they're not going to do that. And it's a pity, because that's the decent human thing to do, right? I mean, if you borrow an idea, it's not a bad thing. That's the idea behind, really, ideally, technology, but in practice, I think only the Free Software Foundation and its ilk. That is the idea, that we can all share ideas and build off of each other's ideas, and that will result in a more universally helpful and more efficient and better technology than if we tried to pretend like no one can have our ideas and we can lock them down, and if anyone steals our ideas, then we need to take them to court and sue them. That's absurd. You can't do that. Nothing happens in a vacuum. There's no way to be exclusive of all other ideas other than your own, because even your idea was probably thought of a long time ago anyway. So it doesn't matter. It's silly to be like that, and it's human. And it's decent to say, hey, I really liked what KDE did in this situation, so I totally stole that idea. Or I really thought that the way GNOME 3 handled its little workspaces thing, thought that was really cool, so we borrowed it for the OS X launch pad, or actually it might have been Mission Control, either one of those two. Complete redesign. It's just like GNOME 3's workspace viewer, except the workspaces are on the top instead of the side. It was astonishing. When I saw it, I thought, wow, someone saw GNOME 3 before they, you know, right before they did this component of OS X Lion. There are little things like, I keep saying little, maybe they're not little, maybe they're big, maybe they're major things. I mean, there are some really major things in there that are really, really like GNU Linux, and you just think it's such a pity that they are going to market it and talk about it, and they're going to present it as their own work. And I don't know about you, but when I was in school, if I did that, I got an F, and it was called plagiarism, and that's that. And they're not going to get that. That's not how they work. They're going to silently omit the attribution for where they're getting these ideas. I'm not saying they have to pay royalties. I'm simply saying it would be humanly decent to mention that some of these ideas came from other places, and they don't. And they're moving away from that every day, of course. I mean, they're trying to move as far from the GPL proper as possible, and that's a pity. And I think the only thing that we can do, really, as responsible computerists, I guess, is to make it known when people are talking about this OS X stuff, to really just politely make it known that, yes, it is very cool. It is very cool that they've got that new workspace viewer that doesn't require people to understand this concept of four virtual desktops, because, hey, I've tried. People don't seem to be able to get that sometimes. But you know, GNOME 3 had that months and months ago, blah, blah, blah. And it's just, it's, it doesn't have to be snarky, it doesn't have to be mean, it doesn't have to be my OS is better than your OS. It can just be a statement. It can be factual attribution. This probably influenced them a little bit. Isn't that interesting? And carry on, you know? I feel like that's really our duty as users of GNU Linux to make it known that even though Apple is going to present this OS as an innovative, progressive product that they came up with, that actually that is not true. And and to point out that they might not even be saying it in so many words. They simply aren't saying that, oh, by the way, we got the idea from these other sets of OSs. I'm not imagining that the designers of Apple, Mac OS, Tin Lion, sat down and studied the KDE and GNOME 3 desktops and just wrote down on a little notebook paper what they could steal, what effects they like, what they could emulate from those things. But I'm also acknowledging that there's just no way that OS X Lion was designed in a closet without any influence from outside progress. We should just do our job, due diligence, make sure that that is also known by other people, because we know that Apple is not going to mention that at all. And that's too bad. That is playing right into the cliche of what the GPL, exactly what the GPL is trying to fight against. Only this is more ideas, and GPL is more about hard code. The ideas, though, that it's the same thing. I guess the better equivalent would be the Creative Commons fighting against this kind of thing, and the GPL fighting for the code. Those two things, I mean, this is exactly what they're fighting against, and it's why they're important. Ever since I've been using Linux, pretty much, I've always kind of been aware of this application called Amarok. It's kind of, in many ways, it's a really famous-feeling application, actually, in Linux. It seems like a lot of people know it really well and kind of swear by it and are really, really solid fans of it. And that's really been cool, and I really kind of admire, actually, that kind of enthusiasm about a project, and I've always been quite aware that the people working on the project and the community surrounding the project, they're an enthusiastic crowd, and I have no problem with that. I have a lot of respect for it, actually. I like an enthusiastic crowd. It's one of the many things that really draws me, I think, to KDE in general. They've got a fan base. They've got people who are interested in proud to be using KDE, and that's really cool to me. So I've always had like this kind of inherited respect for Amarok, and yet I've always said, and I've always been, not really a music app kind of guy. I like InPlayer. I play my album. When the album is over, I go and I find another album and put that on, and that's how I function, and that's how I like it, and I like that InPlayer stays very much out of my way. But recently a friend of mine was looking for a music player for Linux, and the only one I really knew was Amarok. I mean, I've heard of other ones, Rhythmbox, Banshee, stuff like that, but honestly, the one that kind of pops out when I think of music player for Linux, that's Amarok, right? Everyone knows that. Problem is, I hadn't really ever used Amarok in real-world situation. So here I was saying, oh, you should check out Amarok, it's supposed to be really good. I hate that phrase, you know? That's supposed to be a really good app. I don't know what that means, supposed to be a good app. I mean, how is it a good app? Why is it supposed to be good? So here I was recommending it, and so the minute I was finished recommending it, I went back to my own computer and quickly fired up Amarok. Sure enough, it was installed on my Slackware machine, and I started to play around with it. And sure enough, the every time I open Amarok, this is absolutely every time, I open it up, my eyes start twitching, my hand freezes, I panic, I don't know what to do, I close the thing. Why? Because the default layout of Amarok is just horrible. It's terrible. I don't know if you've seen it lately, but if you open that thing up, it's gotten better, but it is just, I don't understand what is going on there. Actually, that's not true. I do understand now, but at that time, I did not understand. So this time I was determined to try to get through it, and actually, sure enough, I kind of figured it out, and 3 weeks later, I'm still using it. Not because I meant to keep using it, it's just fun to use. It's just a good little application. And I never use music playing applications. Interesting, what's going on here? Well, let's explore. Actually, let's not explore, let's just talk about Amarok. So Amarok is a really nice little application. It can stay out of your way, or it can be, you know, your operating system. It can take over your screen, it can manage your music, it can show you wiki pages, it can do whatever you want it to do. So it's a very nice little application. Probably not surprisingly, my my choice configuration of it is fairly minimal. And so here's how you too can fall in love all over again for the very first time with Amarok. First of all, when you start Amarok, well, first of all, when you install Amarok, it's going to pull in half of KDE. If you don't have KDE already, looks like you'll have it after Amarok. So, I mean, I don't know that for a fact, but I do know that it requires a lot of, obviously, Qt and a lot of the KDE libs. So be aware of that. If you're not, if you just aren't running KDE, I think I've heard that Xail, E-X-A-I-L-E, is supposed to be sort of an GTK Amarok sort of thing, so you might want to give that a shot. But I'm going to assume that you, like me, are running KDE, love KDE, and it's just a couple of megabytes more for Amarok, or maybe you're running Slackware and it's already there. So once you start it up first time, it's going to ask you if you'd like to use any particular folder as your main collection. This smacks of iTunes, let me take over your music folder-ism, but it's not. It's completely different. It's got nothing to do with that. All it's asking is what folder should it look in by default to find your, quote, local collection. It's as easy as that. It's not a big deal. It's not going to rearrange anything. It's not going to encapsulate it into a self-contained hidden database conglomeration thing. It's not going to try to manage your music. It's simply going to look at the folder that you tell it to look at. In the past, I've made the mistake of just pointing it at that pre-built music folder that some Linux distributions are doing these days. Personally, I don't see the point. Music is an awfully generic term to me, so I generally create a directory, a folder, and I call it Amarok, and I put all the music that I know that I want to listen to into that directory, which, of course, are all my Fat Chance Lester albums, and that's all I ever listen to. But yes, I put all my Fat Chance Lester albums in the Amarok directory. When Amarok launches for the first time and asks me what's my collection, I point it at Amarok, and it knows to scan that folder for new music and to show me up-to-date listings of what's in that folder. So that's not a big deal. It's not as big of a deal as you might think if you come from other applications that try to manage your music for you and rename things for you and stuff like that. So the layout is the next thing that you'll want to defeat, because the default layout for me, I tried for like 2 minutes maybe at the most to use it. I hate it, can't do it, really, really bad, but it's frankly kind of refreshing to get an application that opens and it's just a blank canvas. I mean, it's not blank. It's actually quite full. It's kind of showing you, hey, here's everything you can choose from, but I think you're supposed to choose. So, and that's what I did. So what I did was I went to, you can do this too. You can go to the view menu and there's a lock layout option there. And by default, that's checked. Uncheck it. Now all the little Qt 4 panels have the little unlock and the close buttons. Or the unanchor, I guess I should say, like float this window or close this window buttons in them. So now you'll see that the little panels in Amarok now have control buttons, and you can close the panels that you don't want, and you can certainly resize the window and resize the panes, you know, the width of each pane. I settled on a two-panel setup. On the left, there was media sources, and on the right, there was playlists. That's all. That's it. That's all you need. You can also look at the view menu, I think it's the view menu, for the top toolbar. So you can use either the small toolbar or the default Amarok toolbar. On my big 22-inch media Slackware machine, I'm using the big Amarok toolbar because I like that big play button and the big circle volume thing. On my little Fedora laptop, not little, but smaller, Fedora laptop, I use the small toolbar because I need the space. I want the screen real estate. And of course, you can turn off the menu, Control M. I always have that off. It's very nice to have. But before you turn that off, be sure to check out Settings, Configure Amarok, because there's a whole bunch of other settings there. So using Amarok turns out to be really easy. You got media sources on the left, or wherever you put it. I put it on the left. And this is where you can always browse your music collection, the one that you defined in the earlier step. So that'll always be there. And then you can also have external drives plugged in, network shares, whatever. It will show up in your media sources. This is kind of nice. If you have an external music drive, you can enable that as a collection all on its own, so that when you do mount it, Amarok sees it and then scans it for new music automatically, and it'll keep it up to date, and it'll feel, you know, it's, when I say music collection, it means that you can define the folder that Amarok sees as sort of the root of that device. So, yes, you have a hard drive, and yes, it's got some backup data on it or something, but it's also got that music directory. Well, you don't need Amarok to know about the backup or the design files or the magazine articles that you're writing. Yes, this is my hard drive. But you just want it to see the music folder, so that music folder will be that device to Amarok. It's a really smart way of managing things. So you've got all that stuff on the left, and you've got, you know, like a little search bar, like a filter bar, so if you've got a lot of music, you can search for a particular word or a song or an artist name, whatever. And you've also got a little spanner icon up in the right of that little panel, a wrench, spanner, whatever you call it. And that if you click on that, that shows you different views of your music, like artist and then album, or album first and then artist, or year, album, artist, or genre, year, artist, album, whatever. You can do it any way you want. I usually am always flipping back and forth between artist and album, or album and artist. On the right, you've got your playlist. And this is really, really simple. The top of the playlist pane is the same as your media sources. You've got your little filter bar. You've got the spanner icon for view options. You've got, I think, a bookmark button for some presets for how you want to view this playlist. And the playlist area is basically a blank canvas. You drag music from the media sources pane on the left into the playlist pane on the right, and you construct a playlist. This is sounding an awful lot like iTunes, right? Well, it's completely not like iTunes. It's actually couldn't be more different than iTunes, because in this case, the big dump file of all your music is on the left, and it's dynamically being kept current. It's not something that you add music to and then it remembers everything you've ever listened to, whether it's actually on your computer anymore or not. It's a representation. It's looking at the files that you have created yourself on your own file system. You move them to the playlist to move them into a queue, essentially. So it's a lot like being your own DJ, basically. That's how I generally do it. If you love your playlists, if you're like a mixtape kind of person, you love to arrange music and listen to it in that order or whatever, you can save your playlists to either disk or to the Amarok database, whichever you feel is more comfortable for yourself and more sustainable for yourself. I know that if I save playlists either way, really, I'm going to lose track of them, so I don't bother, but you can certainly do that. Now, there are a lot of different ways to configure Amarok from the settings menu. Of course, it's a KDE app. It's got a settings menu. You can configure pretty much every aspect. It's really, really cool. You can do the minimal setup. You can do the different views. You can make Amarok talk to all different kinds of network shares or podcasting collections, services, music stores, just whatever you want it to do. At this point, I think it can pretty much do it. It's really, really slick application. And again, this is coming from someone who swore that he would just never have any use for a music playing application ever again. And honestly, I don't have a need for a music playing app at all. MPlayer is fine, MPlayer is perfect, but sometimes it's just fun to use a really well-written, nice little GUI application, and you just use it because it works and it makes life just a little bit more pleasant. And that's how I would summarize Amarok, actually. If you're getting bored with your current player, or if you're looking for a good player and you want to try one, try out Amarok. Another application that I've heard of for quite some time, I mean, ever since I started with Linux, really, it was one of those things that you just kind of heard about, and it's a dedicated Linux distribution, or almost an appliance kind of distribution, because it's got one purpose in life, and that is to copy hard drives, and it's called CloneZilla. Maybe you've heard of it. I'd heard of it. I'd heard of it often, it seems like. It was kind of big news for a while. It seemed like a lot of podcasts would mention it. Never really had a use for it. I mean, I understood the idea, obviously. Cloning a drive, it sounds great. And on the Mac system, there was a Carbon Copy Cloner, is what it was called. It was like a little shareware or freeware. I don't know. It's hard to tell the difference on Mac because no one ever actually pays for the shareware. But it's a little application, basically, that will clone a hard drive from the zeroth byte to the end. No questions asked. Clonezilla is based on Debian, and I think they've got an Ubuntu version as well. I'm not really clear on what the difference between those two would be, but they're both live CDs, and you boot into them, and you can clone a drive. A lot of people, I think, use this for the way I'd heard about it was that they would design it, or they would get a computer exactly where it needed to be as their master image. They would clone that master image to a drive, and then they would take that drive and clone it onto all the other drives around the classroom or the business, the office, you know, whatever they were doing. So, sounds like a very useful tool. Turns out that, as I said, I never needed it, but then it turns out that just literally today, actually, one of the people in the finance department had their computer start to fail. Some messages about drive failure being imminent and random things like that. Now, normally, the person who deals with that department is a Windows person, and that because those are literally the only three Windows machines running in the entire organization, which is the financial software stuff. So that's not usually my domain. I don't have to deal with that. It's a sort of self-contained little network of finance stuff. But it's payroll time, and the computer's about to die, and the person who needs to fix it is not in. So obviously the task falls upon me. And I didn't really know what to do, because this is a Windows machine we're talking about, and I never used Windows still. I mean, I've sat in front of it, I've clicked on a few buttons, but that's it. So I really didn't know what to do. Happily, did a little bit of research into this old distribution that I kind of remembered. Sure enough, it was still around. Clonezilla, 2011, I think July, was their latest release. And I downloaded it. It's a quick install. It's a quick download. It's only 180 megabytes or so. Burn it to disk, took it over to the building where the financial people were, and grabbed the computer, put it on a workbench, booted from the CD, and it just fired up right away. It gave me some super simple options. It allowed me to be in noob mode if I wanted to be. I think they call it beginner mode. And I tried that first, because I'd never done anything like this before. Wanted to keep it simple for myself. Tried that. And it started to attempt to clone the dying drive to the fresh new drive that I hooked up to the computer via a SATA to USB adapter. Didn't actually work. It actually failed. So then I went into expert mode, told it to do a FSCK where possible. I didn't know if FSCK could actually work on a NTFS or VFAT volume, whatever it was, but I told it to do it anyway. And then I told it to skip the bad blocks. Just go ahead and copy right through them. Bad blocks can't be rescued, just skip over it. This took a while. Once I started that one, it took a while for it to actually process that whole disk, but wouldn't you know, when I got back from relaxing in a cafe for about 4 hours, the whole drive had been copied to the new drive, and Clonezilla was just sitting there happily waiting my next command. It was really, really cool. I have never had really an experience with such a specific Linux before. You know, I've had live CDs. I've looked at maybe I've certainly looked at a SIP, VoIP dedicated distribution, but I've never really been a user of one of these kinds of. This distribution is an application almost. You know, it's like it's its own little software application, even though we know that it's running the kernel and it's running all this other stuff and it's probably using DD on the back end. We know that, but the feel of it is, oh, here's a free application called Clonezilla. I'm going to download it. I'm going to boot off of it. It's going to step me through some super simple menus on what I want to do. And you can do a lot, believe me. You can copy the hard drive to a remote drive or to a local drive. You've got a lot of options. It's really, really impressive. It's got a lot of support for all kinds of different file systems. Brilliant stuff. And it worked like a charm. I mean, not only was it easy, easy, and not only was it easy to figure out how to fix the problems that did arise, but it was great. It worked. You know, I put in the new drive after it was all finished, booted up the machine, and sure enough, it completely was as if though nothing had changed. So I just can't speak highly enough of Clonezilla from this one experience, but I mean, it's one of those times when the experience had the potential of being a very bad and stressful experience, but instead Clonezilla made it really a day off, practically, because I started it and I went and wrote and drank coffee in a cafe and got back and it was finished. That's a free day. So thank you, Clonezilla, and if you yourself, dear listener, have any need to clone a drive, whether it's to image it to other computers or to rescue something that you fear could be dying soon and you'd rather not have to rebuild the whole thing, check out Clonezilla. Okay, it's probably time for a coffee break now. This is actually the time we would be wrapping up the episode normally, but hey, it's the season finale. We're not going to wrap it up yet. Get a cup of coffee and come right back. Come back. Ah, there's nothing better than a season finale and a good cup of coffee. Actually, a good cup of coffee and a biscotti is not a bad combination, but season finale is pretty good too. I wanted to talk about this idea of diversity and choice in free software, because this is one of those interesting topics, or is these interesting notions that is simultaneously widely considered the strength and the greatest weakness of free software. It's really kind of unique in that way, I think. Free software, of course, because of its nature, and that is that anyone can start writing software if they want to and release it to the world for free, it is given to a lot of choice. There's a lot of diversity in it. And a lot of people see this as a wonderful thing because, well, that means that if you don't absolutely love one implementation of some idea or one way of doing some task, then quite possibly there's another implementation of it existing out there somewhere. And this sounds like a great thing, right? I mean, it really does. It sounds like a huge strength because, yes, if I don't like this photo manager, then there may be two or three or five other ones out there that I could try instead. It's fantastic. The part that sort of turns people off from the whole thing is when they look at one photo manager and don't like that, and then they turn their attention to another, and they like most of it, but it's not quite done yet. There's a lot of features missing, there's a couple buttons that are broken, and then they try another one, and the website seemed very, very promising. It seemed like it was tailor-made for them, but then they download it, and nothing works. The thing crashes when you launch it, and the last code push or commit was 9 months ago, or worse yet, 3 years ago. The whole idea of, yes, there's a lot of choice in free software gets really, really ugly once you see that four out of the five choices you've been presented with don't actually work either as advertised or the way that you want them to. Obviously, this is a big topic, and it all gets rolled in, just like I just rolled it into one kind of scenario. That's how it happens generally, I think, when people both inside of free software and outside of the free software world look at the issue. So we say, yes, there's a lot of choice, and what we really mean is that there is a lot of code out there, and that's not the same thing, if you think about it, as there being a lot of choice. Because a lot of choice implies that these entities are valid options, so that's not always necessarily the case. There may be a lot of code out there. That doesn't mean that all that code is going to run, and that doesn't mean all that code is going to work. So there's a careful distinction that we have to make in our minds, and even when we're speaking of free software, it's not fair to anyone to say, well, there's so much choice in free software, look at all these video editors, and look at all these photo manipulation programs, and so on, if half of the things that we're saying exist don't really functionally exist. That just means that there's a lot of opportunity in the free software world. It's quite different than a lot of choice. So that's one side, or that's one aspect of this topic, and that's an important distinction to make, I think. Another aspect to this, though, is the fact that some projects simply get more attention and more work done on them than others. Why is that? Well, it could be a variety of different reasons. Maybe the project lead is a jerk and no one wants to work with him or her. Or maybe a big company has kind of sat down and said, you know what, this project is a really good project and we are actually looking for a custom solution for this purpose. Let's start backing this project. Let's dedicate programmers to it. And things get done that way. Or maybe it's a great project, but just people aren't really into it, or they just haven't found it yet. And so progress is slow. Or maybe it's a very heuristic kind of programming task, and that no one can, you can't really have a bunch of people coding on it because it's something that needs to get done by this person who's still got it in their brain, and it's just a matter of time and effort to get it out into the actual code base and through the compiler. So lots of different reasons for certain projects to have gotten more or less attention, to progress more faster or slower than others. So all of this so far has seemed kind of almost self-evident. Although I don't think it's always on our mind. I don't think we always necessarily remember it and think about it and consider it, even though it is, even though some of them are self-evident. But the problem, I think, becomes when people, either within or without the free software world, and by the free software world, I'm obviously talking about us, the people listening to this show, the people who call themselves free software enthusiasts or advocates or whatever, the people who have kind of subscribed to this world or this movement of free software-ness, and there's an awareness, yes, there's this thing of free software, and yes, we are going to care for it and kind of encourage it and promote it and contribute to it, that sort of person, rather than the way you or I may have been before we found Linux and started really getting into it, right? Where you'd be using your OS, you were a power user probably, and you knew about all this freeware that was available, and it was cool, and maybe sometimes you'd see the random penguin logo for some reason, but weren't really sure what that was all about. That's not the free software world that I'm talking about. I'm talking about the free software world. People within the free software world start really worrying about what people without the free software world think of the free software world, right? We're starting to get kind of concerned about the impression that we are making, the marketing footprint we are putting forward. How is the world perceiving us? How is the world perceiving and receiving us? I think that this can become an issue, and I think that I know that I myself have fallen prey to it, and still do to some degree. Times where I think, why does this application have such a bad name, GUVC View? I can't pitch that to my boss as the webcam application that we're going to use on this platform. He can't even say the name, much less grasp that it's a proper application. You know, little things like that. You get really, really concerned about the impression that that this free software world is making, because you want it to look good when you show it to people, and that's understandable. But you have to temper that, and I think what happens sometimes within the free software world is that we get so concerned about how things are being perceived from the outside, on the outside, and that what people might think about what we're doing and all this other stuff, that it becomes problematic. It starts to stand in the way of the freedom of the free software world. And I'm actually speaking really, really, I'm speaking around a very specific set of incidences where I've been involved in two distinct projects that knew nothing of each other, and I found them independently of each other, and was involved with them to some degree. And in both instances, a group of people from a third-party project that is fairly well-known within the free software world, members of these projects have come into the IRC channels and literally and unabashedly discouraged these smaller projects from continuing, because they stated that by existing, these smaller projects were actually hurting this larger third-party project, because it was splintering the free software world. It was driving stakes into the unity and the conformity, I guess, of the free software world. And it would be much better for all these other projects, these smaller projects, to simply abandon their work and go contribute, whether they may even have the ability or not to really contribute to that to another project, but they should go contribute to the larger project and support that larger project. It's crazy It sounds crazy, but it happened. I was there for it, and I'm obviously not naming names because I don't think that's the important thing. I think that the concept is more important. And I was very deeply disturbed when this happened, when I actually saw in two separate instances the same project descending down from the sky and saying, you guys shouldn't even exist. You should either help us or just call it quits because you're hurting the cause, quote-unquote, the cause. Hey, I'm all for the cause. I love the cause. I like having a cause. I really dig that sort of revolutionary mindset. But when that cause starts to step in and quell freedom within a free software system, I find few issues with that. So this illusion that there should be less choice and less diversity in the free software world, I think, is really quite dangerous. And I think that, sure, let's say you've got, randomly picking an example here, video editor. Let's randomly pick a project, PITIV, PITIVI. Pretty well-known project. They're kind of a video editing project that tends to get a lot of publicity or tends to get a lot of attention within the free software world. Interestingly, it's not the video editing project that I really am interested in. I mean, I don't use it, and when I have tried to use it in the past, I have found it simply not acceptable, or it's just not a good fit for what I do, the way that I work on video. Doesn't mean it's a bad project. It simply means that it doesn't fit my workflow and my needs and things like that. If we take out the word free and software from this discussion, you might start to think that I'm talking about proprietary software, because that's exactly the issue that I've got over in the proprietary world. There's a big project, let's say Final Cut Pro. It doesn't fit my needs, it doesn't fit my workflow. It's restrictions on different codecs, and the way that it forces you to work and manage your projects, and the way that it has so much bloat, and all of these other things, that doesn't work for me. Oh, also the fact that it doesn't run on the platform that I want, and doesn't open the code, all that stuff, it just doesn't work for me. Is there another choice? Well, yeah, there are other choices. There's Adobe Premiere, and I think that's probably about it for Mac, but they exist. They still don't work for me, so no, there's not another choice, really, because it's basically the same problems in a different wrapping. So there's not enough choice, and certainly within those applications, there's no choice. Final Cut isn't exactly flexible. It doesn't exactly let you do things differently. It's very much hard-coded. It can do what it can do, and that's about it. So that's the problem. There's not enough choice in this non-free software world, and conversely, we have lots of choices in the free software world. And I've got a lot of faith in the free software world, and I've got a lot of faith in choices. And I think that all of these things can coexist peacefully without saying we must be the only project of our type so that we can be the shining star of free software. There can be lots of shining stars of free software, honestly. I mean, if you think about it, Firefox is Firefox, and then there was Conqueror as well. And Conqueror, if the Mozilla people went into the Conqueror IRC channel and said, hey, you guys shouldn't exist because you're competing with our freedom, and we want to be the shining thing of the free software world, well then KHTML would have never really been developed, and look at what happened to KHTML, right? It got adopted and then sort of taken over by Apple, but I mean, the result is WebKit, and everyone seems to be pretty excited about that. So it is in its own right this shining beacon of free software. The branding got a little bit appropriated, I admit, but even so, the result was great free code. So for anyone to say, again, just randomly picking a project here, to say, for instance, that PITIV should be the only video editor, and that everyone must contribute to PITIV, or else they are hurting the free software marketing scheme, it's wrong on many, many levels. It would be wrong on, because not all programmers are going to be able to flock toward one project and contribute meaningfully to it. Doesn't necessarily work that way. Two, it might be the wrong project. You know, I mean, it might be a great little shining star of free software for one group of people, but to me, at a professional film production facility trying to promote free software, there's just that if PITIV was the free software video editor that everyone was contributing to, free software, even if PITIV was really solid, free software would be useless to the facility where I work, because that's just not the level of free of video editing that they are looking for. It would be it would be useless to pitch that to them. I might as well go and pitch iMovie to them, or Windows Media Movie Maker. It would be useless to this particular niche of people. So that's why it's such a great thing that, for instance, KTN Live exists, and NovaCut is on its way to existing with their $25,000 grant that they got from Kickstarter, it is a grant, but they made that happen. And even Auteur Editor by, that's weird, that's Auteur and NovaCut are two projects that I was involved with, and PityV is kind of this big monolithic third-party video editor. Well, that's a weird coincidence. Of course, I'm not actually speaking of those projects, but it's a great example because it's exactly what I started out with. Yeah, so Auteur and NovaCut, two smaller video editors. PityV, a fairly large, public-facing kind of video editor. If it were to ever happen that PityV were to go into the IRC channels of NovaCut and Auteur Editor and discourage those projects from existing, that would be, I think, a mistake. And I would never want that to happen in real life. So I think taking it outside of any kind of specific examples or anything, I think my point is that while I understand that there's a desire for something to exist in a very strong, solid state, we want that beacon and that sort of statuesque kind of, this is our application, let's make it free and we'll make it multi-cross-platform, and it'll just be a big behemoth of free software, and that's going to be the one that we can all point to and say, there's our work. That's what free software produces. That would be great if free software was a corporate giant that was trying to compete in the market with Microsoft and Apple, and I realize that on one sense it is. We are trying to compete with Apple and Microsoft, and yet in a very real sense we're not that. We are, the free software world is not a megacorp that is going to bundle up all of its applications and put it on the shelf and compete. That's just not the function of free software, and that will never be the function of free software, because free software simply is not an entity. Even though I'm calling it a world, it really isn't a thing that you can hold in your hand. It's a bunch of people who happen to all be writing code and giving it away for free. And if there's any kind of collusion between those people and awareness that each other exist, okay, that's great, and that's a community. But that's not a big company out there trying to put their products out and compete head-to-head with other big companies. Now, if a project feels like doing that and becoming a little company, as it were, in itself, I mean, obviously Mozilla Firefox is kind of, in many ways, that. It's a small, big corporation that can compete with the big browsers. And of course, there's LibreOffice, and there's Blender, and all those typical ones that you kind of hear about as the big free software titles, the heavyweights. That's great that they're doing that, but never should anyone try to bundle all those together and say, this is free software, and if you're contributing to some other smaller free software project, then you're hurting this entity. Because, I mean, hey, maybe I don't consider myself part of your entity, your company, your public-facing image. Maybe your image isn't the right image for me. Whatever. The freedom of being able to develop this stuff and package it in the way that you want to, and come up with alternatives, and change things. I mean, that's what free software is all about. That's what the true attraction is, that freedom. It's appealing sometimes, like when you sit back and think, wow, wouldn't it be great if I could just show my boss or my friend this set of software, and they'd just switch over, and I'd be the hero for the day, and everyone would be using Linux in the building, and that would be fun. Yeah, that's really appealing, that's really cool, and I understand that desire. But on the other hand, at the end of the day, the thing I really love is the ability to do whatever the heck I want with the code that I'm downloading, and be able to look around and find code that appeals to me, find a software package that works the way I want it to work. That's the stuff that I like about free software. That's why we're all here, so we should probably perpetuate that. Well, since we're sitting around chatting, I might as well bring up the ever-popular HFS Plus issue. HFS Plus is the Mac OS X file system, and when I say the Mac OS X file system, I pretty much mean that. It is the OS X file system. If you want a different choice, a different option for your file system, you really don't have much of a choice. You can use VFAT, but I don't know if you can even use that for your main operating environment. I don't know that that would work. I've never tried that. But in terms of external drives, formatting them to talk to other computers, VFAT is your choice. It's really pretty shameful. And just before every release of OS X, you hear rumors about how ZFS is going to be integrated into OS X. But so far, that's just not apparently a priority at all. And for a little while, they had modest support for UFS, the Unix file system BSD, FreeBSD uses. And even that, I mean, I tried that, and that was really, really not great support. There were a lot of issues with that. So HFS then. So I've never 100% trusted HFS, at least not since some early experiences about hard drives not really failing, but literally just losing their super block sort of or whatever the identifier on this file system is to tell the computer what file system that is. It seemed to have gotten corrupted or something, and that happened not once, but often. Well, often enough to really stick in my mind. And these were early experiences on OS X, you know, I mean, before I even knew what a file system was. One of those drives I'd actually kept around for quite a while, and I went back fairly recently and looked at it again. And now I can say, well, I think what the issue was, or is that that the file system doesn't know what kind of file, or the computer doesn't know what kind of file system it is. There's no identifier there. The data, as far as I can tell, is there. It's intact. It just doesn't know how to mount it. So weird little issues like that were very, very frequent, and they've always made me suspicious of HFS Plus. And when I was doing some work for a company back in California, there were a few people who did a lot of work with HFS Plus, and they were pretty excited about it in general. And, you know, they were excited because it was a journal file system and stuff like that. And by that time, I knew a little bit about file systems. Not a whole lot, but I knew what journaled was. I knew why that was a big deal and why that was important. So anyway, when I got this most recent job that I've got, where I'm managing, you know, 200 Macintosh computers on a Linux network, that kind of made me think, gee, it would be really interesting to start really paying attention to HFS Plus performance, HFS Plus failure rate, just kind of get a feel for this on a larger scale than simply, oh, I had a thumb drive once and I noticed that it crashed. Not all that scientific. Well, I still don't have really scientific tests available, but I've gotten a pretty good idea of some of the issues that really I could expect if someone said, here's our network or here's our computer farm and we're using HFS file system. There do seem to be a couple of issues with HFS Plus file systems. I don't know why, and I don't have statistics, I don't have percentages, and it's still kind of on my little to-do list to set up a proper test lab and actually run real tests against HFS. I mean, things that I can pull percentages from, things that I can pinpoint and say, okay, if I do this enough times, then it will break, that kind of deal. I would like to do that, not just for HFS. I'd like to do that for EXT4 and for whatever else, you know, just kind of have a little lab set up for that, and that's within, eventually that might be within my ability, so it is something that's on my list, but I haven't done it yet. But there are definite issues on HFS Plus, on Mac OS, and I wanted to talk about them because I want to see if any of this sounds familiar to other people with other file systems, because honestly, so far, my very modest experience with file systems can be summed up in a lifetime of HFS Plus, and then very recent, you know, EXT, whatever, 2, 3, 4, that kind of thing. So the background that I have is not very diverse, and it's not at all scientific. So HFS, I'm experiencing about 5 different repeated problems. Lots and lots of mounting and unmounting failures. The Mac OS X Finder frequently fails to properly unmount a removable HFS Plus volume. And I say frequently, and I almost I feel like that's a really lightweight word for the problem. I can almost predict that in a room of 16 users, certainly at least one is going to have an unmounting failure. If they're unmounting a thumb drive or a hard drive from their computer, there's going to be a failure when they're unmounting. That's all it takes. Fewer than 20 people in a room, there's going to be one failure. And I'd almost bet a very small amount of money on that. If we went around to a couple of different rooms with 20 users in it, had everyone mount their HFS volume and then try to unmount it, I think I'd come out on top with a bet like that. It happens that frequently. Now I realize there's a lot of variables there. Well, what kind of thumb drive are they using? What brand is it? What version of USB is it using? What's the real specs of it? What if it's not a thumb drive, it's one of those little passport drives or whatever. What kind of cable is it using? What's the history of the drive? All these issues. I don't care. If it's an HFS for volume and there's a set amount of people, one of them is going to have a problem unmounting the drive, and they're going to have to just pull it out or whatever. So, very common problem. Copy crashes. This one is again, something I would actually probably put money on. If you're going to copy files from one HFS volume to another HFS volume, you're going to have problems. This one's a fuzzy one, though, because I don't know where the problem exists. I can't figure out if it's in the file system itself, or if it's simply if you're copying from the Finder, or what. So I'm not sure, and the only reason I'm not clear on this is because when I do the copies either from the Finder or the terminal, I see errors. Obviously, the terminal gives me a little bit more information on the errors. The Finder kind of just says, had a problem, or alternately, it just crashes, and I don't know what the problem is. Whereas if I do the automated information migration tool that ships with Mac, there are apparently no errors. And that doesn't obviously at all mean that there are no errors, but there are no errors reported. So I'm kind of blaming the file system simply because the terminal shouldn't give me errors if the only problem is the Finder. So I'm kind of blaming it on the file system, but I could be mistaken. The third problem is journal corruption after ejecting an HFS volume that may or may not claim to have done a successful unmount. Again, I can assure you that there's going to be a failed unmount in there somewhere. But if you remove the thing, the journal of the volume becomes corrupted, and this results in either corrupted files or, in a few cases, a corrupted volume that is then forced into being a read-only until the user reformats it. Very, very strange problem. Again, not sure what's causing that kind of issue, but I'm chalking it up to journal corruption because it feels like that, but I could be wrong. Another feeling of journal corruption I'm getting is when pulling an HFS volume from the computer without properly ejecting it. So, I mean, you're not supposed to do that, but people do it all the time. So you pull the drive out. You don't warn the computer. You simply pull the drive. It's going to result in journal corruption. And I almost wouldn't bother making this point because it's not kind of not fair, right, to just yank a drive out of the hard drive, out of the computer. But as a comparative point, the EXT volumes on my Linux boxes have not suffered this fate to date anyway. And the VFAT volumes, shamefully, that I use on the Mac, and again, I do this sort of thing, and that's not even a journaled file system unless I'm mistaken, they don't seem to suffer any kind of issue with that. It's literally only the HFS file system. So I don't know what the macOS and Finder is trying to do. I don't know what the problem is, but it's an issue, and it's very, very noticeable. Corruption, crashes, and just general failures. And even if the failure doesn't result in any bad thing happening, you still have to wonder about something that keeps throwing errors every time you do something. It's kind of scary for the user. It's kind of scary for you as the system administer kind of person. So, and then the final problem is really, I think it's possibly a larger problem with specifically the Finder in macOS 10, but it really has an issue with network shares. You know, if you've got a shared HFS, if you've got a server somewhere running HFS and you've got Netatalk or whatever they call it in Apple land, what do they call it? The thing that Netatalk emulates, AFP. If you've got AFP running on this server, and it's an HFS volume, so you've got people who are going to sign in. It's like a Samba share. You know, they're going to sign in with their account and look at all these shared files. I get emails all the time from people. What am I doing wrong? Every time I sign onto the server, it starts to crashes, and I have to, you know, restart the Finder or restart the computer, whatever. The user, I don't think, is doing anything wrong, and I have a lot more success with Samba shares, and that's the only two options you really have, are either AFP or Samba share. But the AFP shares, when there's any kind of glitch, apparently, it crashes the users, usually their desktop, but more often than not, they have to reboot to get themselves out of that crash. And the same thing goes for those evil copy crashes. You're copying from HFS to HFS in the Finder, not using a terminal, just using their GUI implementation. A crash means a reboot. I mean, it's that. It just hangs everything. You can't get out of that copy. I mean, you can do other stuff, but you have to live with the knowledge that that crashed copy process is running in the background that entire time. So, kind of annoying. So these are real issues with the HFS file system that I've had. Once again, I don't think people talk about it because really most Mac users don't use Macs in a big enough environment to notice this kind of thing. And it's something that they notice the couple of times they actually do move a big bulk of files from an HFS volume to another HFS volume, which isn't all that often. I used to see it on a personal level when I was doing freelance video editing, and I would take a client's hard drive and I would transfer their information from their drive to mine, or the project from mine to theirs. That was always a scary process, and we literally used to do that bit by bit. We would piecemeal it over, because you just knew. It was a foregone conclusion that if you selected everything in that folder and you moved it over to the client's hard drive, it was going to crash. It was going to crash your computer, and you'd have to start over. And after you've copied files for 30 minutes and you come back and the thing is hung, you don't know what really got copied over and what didn't get copied over, so you'd have to just restart from the top. So that one I'd noticed on a real-life personal level. The other ones I think maybe I'm noticing more because I've got a wider sample. You know, I've got 200 computers and 200 users that will let me know if something goes wrong. So yeah, I don't think it gets talked about. I think that a lot of the Mac issues that you don't hear about are that way. They exist a lot, but there's not enough of a tech community behind the Macs, or I should say not enough of a system administrator community behind the Macs to really even notice the problems or discuss them, because people are just like, oh yeah, I've heard other people with that problem, but oh well, whatever. And it's not really talked about because there's just not that many Macs in one area at one time for people to start noticing, hey, there's that problem, isn't there? And that always kind of cracks me up when people see a Linux shirt that I have on, or an anti-Windows shirt that I might have on, and they'll start talking to me about how great their Mac is. You know, they've never experienced this or that and this, and I'm just thinking, yeah, you've never experienced it because you're like one user who doesn't know computers, and all of those crashes are just kind of weird issues that you kind of work around as quickly as possible. That doesn't mean it's really actually working better than another platform. It just means that you are better at ignoring the problem, and that the internets aren't talking about the problems because everyone like you ignore the problem. I mean, if you've ever gone to a Mac forum, then you'll know how useless, generally speaking, the Mac quote-unquote community is. They just have no clue what they're talking about. They have no propensity to troubleshoot. They have no ability to identify problems. I've asked way too many questions on the Mac forums, especially since working here with 200 Macintoshes. See, big problems, important problems that I needed to get fixed, and thought, well, the natural place is the forum, right? You post to the forum and the answers are just phenomenally stupid. I mean, they're just like, you shouldn't be doing that if it's crashing your computer. You know, no, that's not the answer. That's never the answer. There's got to be something to do to make, you know, to recover this room of 20 Macintosh computers that got crashed because of an update. There's got to be a way to reverse that. There is no way. You shouldn't have updated it. You know, so reinstall your OS. It's just like, what are you talking about? So yeah, the community as it is isn't very useful, and they're not very good at reporting or identifying problems. Well, identifying first of all, and then reporting secondly, because of course Apple gives no recourse. You can't really report the problem. There's no public bug forum or bug reporting mechanism. So yeah, they can't identify it, much less report it, and that's the state of things. So next time someone says that Mac OS just never crashes or never has any problems, whatever marketing blurb they decided to repeat, internalize and then repeat outwardly, let them know that proper stress testing might reveal a different story. I'm just itching at this point to get into listener feedback, but I've got other topics to cover first, so we're going to postpone listener feedback until the second hour of the show. First, I want to touch on printers. Now, printers are kind of it's a roller coaster, emotional roller coaster with printers, I think, for everyone, actually. I think some people might be under the impression that printer woes are a Linux world kind of thing, but actually I will have you know that really everyone suffers from this affliction, the affliction being that printers are just horrible inventions. I mean, they're really cool, they're really neat that we can generate stuff on a screen and then get it more or less out on a hard substance paper, cardboard, specialty paper, t-shirt, transfer paper, all that stuff is really cool. But wow, I mean, if there's ever a better example of something that was a good idea, really, really badly implemented, it would be the way that printers and computers talk to each other. It seems so simple, right? I mean, how many different ways are there to get an image from one device, you know, it's a set of data from one device to another, and have that other one output it in the way that it is designed to output the stuff. It just doesn't seem that complex, and yet, who among us have not had one of those experiences with a printer where just no matter what you do, it's just never quite right? And I mean that on every level that you can imagine, whether it's talking to your computer and vice versa, or if it's color matching, or if it's troubles with ink, or trouble with the little mechanisms inside, those little gears and stuff that always break. Whatever it is, you've had a problem with it. I know this. I can sense it through the portable media player that you're listening to this show on. You've had these problems. So we all know what I'm talking about. Printers are horrible. To make matters worse, of course, when you go to the store or even online store to buy a printer, because for whatever reason you have it in your mind that it would be a good idea to purchase a printer. Believe me, it's a bad idea, but for whatever reason you think it's a good idea, you go to buy it, you look on the box, it says designed especially for Windows 7, and nowadays it says designed especially also for Mac, and of course there's no little penguin on any of the boxes, so does it work with Linux? Does it not work with Linux? We don't know, because apparently it's just not something that they're going to put on a box. Now, for some of you, that might be a very unusual experience. You might think, how can it not have my OS's logo on the box? For me, that's actually status quo, and going to a store and seeing a Mac icon on a box is actually a really new thing for me. I mean, I still remember going to computer stores with my dad, with Gort, we would be looking for something that actually could work on a Mac, and it was just like, it was just a crapshoot. You never really know. So the fact that that's occurring now is kind of really startling to me, but of course now I don't use that logo OS anymore, and I'm back to an OS that doesn't get its logo on that many boxes, and I've talked about that before, and I think it's who knows what it is? People, companies don't care, companies don't know. I don't really, honestly, have any clue. Point being that it's difficult to find out whether something is really supported on your OS or not. Conversely, it's actually really simple nowadays because there is the internet, and the internet knows everything. So you can search for such and such a printer and see if it's supported. The problem with printers, I think, is that typically, or quite often, they're almost sort of weirdly impulse buys. I mean, it's not like you just are out shopping and say, oh, I think I'll pick up a printer now. But it's kind of one of those desperate moves. You know that you need stuff printed. You know that your other one has just died, or it's not printing the quality that you need. So you need a new one, and so you're going to get a printer, and you can't be bothered to compare your list of potential printers that you can potentially afford with the list of printers that are actually really well supported on Linux, and to actually kind of reverse engineer what the internet is telling you in terms of, well, how well does it work on Linux? Are these rave reviews for real, or are they rave reviews from people who used the printer once after someone else set it up for them and now they're raving about it? You know, so it's kind of weird. Point is, I would like to tell you that you don't have to panic over printers anymore. There are a couple of steps that I have started to take for myself with printers and Linux, and it's really quite simple. First of all, you need to mentally bookmark the site openprinting.org. Openprinting.org is a service of the Linux Foundation. I talked to John Mad Dog Hall about the site at the Southeast Linux Fest this year. Just kind of mentioned it to him, told him it was great, encouraged him to tell his pals over at Linux Foundation that continuing this site would be a great, great thing. Now, the incredible thing about openprinting.org is that it's, well, it, I equate it in many ways to cups, because, I mean, obviously the two are fairly related, because cups also obviously is all about printing on Linux and Unix, so openprinting.org is obviously going to have some kind of inherent tie to cups. I mean, not an official business tie, but, like, you're going to find cups on Open Printing. So that means that not only is openprinting.org good for your GNU Linux needs, but it actually happens to be really good for most of my OS X needs here at work. And ever since I started working here, nary a proprietary driver, I think, has had to go on to the Macs here in the building for them to print to the various printers that they want to use. I use all of the Fumatic and the Ghost Print, and there's one more. It's PXL Mono, I think, for Ricoh drivers, and something else for HP, or maybe actually I think I might use the HP driver. So that's the proprietary one. But the Ricoh big office printers and stuff, it's all free drivers. It's kind of nice. And it's all from openprinting.org. It's brilliant. Someone gets a new printer in their office, first stop, openprinting.org. And that's, again, for both OS X and GNU Linux. Installing printers, printer drivers, rather, is not actually very difficult. I remember when I first had to do it on Linux, I really didn't know what I was doing. I thought, this is really confusing. There are drivers, there are PPDs, what do I do? Well, it turns out that you can first look for a driver, and honestly, if you're around a lot of printers, or if you're really desperate, you can install a bunch of printer drivers from your package manager and just let your computer figure it out for you. That's one of the easiest ways to do it at this point. It's not what I usually like to do on my personal computers, that I like to kind of feel like they're, I don't want to say that they're trim, you know, like, because, I mean, they have a lot of stuff on them, but I just don't like unnecessary stuff, I guess, and especially since I try to avoid printing at all costs anyway, because I don't like to deal with the disappointment of the colors not matching, and the paper not being good enough and all that other stuff. If I'm going to print, I just take stuff to a print shop. You know, that's the end of the story for me, but at work, that's not the case, and so at one point I was printing out some props, and I needed to print I needed to go to a printer, one of the print labs here in the building, and use, it was a small consumer little printer, it wasn't one of the big Epson, like, 10,000s, which is, like, huge and complex, and I've not actually looked into drivers for that, because I don't need to print anything that major, but there was a little Epson 800, or R800, or something like that, little desktop printer. I plug in my Fedora 14 laptop, because that was at the time what I was using. It's actually Fedora 15 at this point, but anyway, Fedora 14 at the time, plug it into the printer, I'm all ready to hit openprinting.org and get the driver and stuff like that. Wouldn't you know, the minute I plug the printer in, there's a little notification popping up from the KDE notification tray, says Epson Stylus 800 is ready. And I think, wow, that's really odd. I guess it must have, like, gotten the information from the USB cable, you know, from that connection. It must be sending some kind of identification, you know, a name to the computer, and it's identifying that something has been plugged in, and that thing is called Epson Stylus 800. Probably has no idea it's a printer. I'm still going to need to install drivers. But I thought, well, why not open GIMP first and just see? So I open up GIMP, get the file up, go to page setup. Everything looks normal. I go to print, and the thing prints just like that, magically. No printers no printer drivers to install, no cups to configure. It just prints. It was literally the first time in my life that I'd had that kind of experience. Every other computer I've ever had, if I plug it into a printer, it's a matter of going to system preferences or system settings or localhost :631, always some kind of setup. And on this thing, it just printed as if though by magic. Same goes for my big, mean workstation Slackware box in my office. I loaded up you know, just the whole collection of like Fumatic and Ghost Print, and probably a couple more. I don't really remember. Those are the two that stick in my mind because I'm always using those. Load those up, and it's ready to go. It's ready to tackle practically any printer out there. So it's getting a lot easier. Now, if for whatever reason you're up against a printer that isn't covered by one of those packages, then you can still hit up openprinting.org, either look for a driver, or you can simply install the PPD. And the PPD at least will help the computer send very generic, or sometimes very specific, actually, it just kind of depends on the compatibility and stuff, I guess. It will help the computer send enough information to that printer, hopefully, to get what you want. You might not have all the features of the printer that you see on a Windows box or a Mac box, although, frankly, the Mac drivers ain't that good either, to be honest. There have been a lot of print drivers, even the proprietary ones, from the manufacturer. The drivers just don't have all the features on the Mac. A really, really significant one was the cover page. Couldn't turn the cover page printing off on a, I think it might have been a Xerox printer. Maybe Ricoh, but it was a big office printer. And there was a Ricoh or a Xerox driver packaged for the Mac. You would install it, and there was just nothing in that dialog that would let you turn off the cover page. So anytime anyone was printing, you'd always get a one sheet of paper being printed with their name on it, the time that they're printing. You know, stupid information like that. There was always a cover page. And we contacted the company about it, and they were just like, yeah, we don't support that on Mac. You can't turn that off on Mac. It's just weird. So, you know, we're not the only ones. Might not get all the fancy features that the printer may advertise that you should have. I don't know, full duplex or stuff like that. I don't really print that much. I don't really know what you're missing out on, and I don't really care, but I'm sure some people do. So either way, even if it's just a generic, okay, print this printer, then at least you're still getting to use your printer. So that's something to look into. Now, the PPD usually, so far in my experience, has been configured through CUPS. And, of course, I covered CUPS way back when I discovered it. I discovered CUPS. Yes, I know that you thought that maybe you had discovered CUPS, or the person who wrote the program had discovered CUPS. But actually, it was me. I discovered it and covered it first here on this show when it was called The Bad Apples. Way back when, like I think in season one, I'm pretty sure, because it was just the coolest thing I'd ever seen. And it still is the coolest thing I have ever seen. And it's, CUPS 1.4.8 now, and it looks really fancy and nice because, of course, Apple bought it up, as we all know. And they're maintaining it, and luckily it hasn't broken yet, so everything's good. But you can go in there and manage printers and add printers. You'll probably have to put in your password, unless you're in, I guess, the Wheel group. But you can add the printer. Nope, still have to put in your password. Doesn't matter who you are. And you add a printer, and you can define how it's connected to your computer. I usually use LPR, but obviously it kind of depends. I mean, if it's USB, then you should use that. You kind of got to go with what's, I guess, obvious. And you can define where it is located, and eventually you'll get to the screen where it offers to let you upload or to define, rather, your own PPD file, and you can utilize that PPD file to give CUPS some idea, some notion of how to send all that information to the printer. And of course, I'm speaking fairly generically here in terms of what the PPD file does, because I really don't know for sure how it all works. I'm just saying, in my experience, that seems to be what's going on. Either way, it is a very easy install, and I wouldn't get too nervous about it. It's very simple. And that's if your computer already isn't recognizing the printer. So the third and final tip that I got for printers would be to learn CUPS. And like I say, on Fedora, actually, I have had the very, very pleasant experience of not being able to find a printer that it won't talk to. It's just been that smooth for me so far. Not that I've actually tried that many printers, but I'm just saying, lots of printers in this building for the graphic designers, and I have not plugged it into one that I need to use yet and had it not recognize it already. Very, very nice. My Slackware desktop machine really only talks to one printer, well, three, but they're all Ricohs, and they all basically use the same PXL mono driver. And it's not mono, it's just PXL is what it's called. But learn CUPS if you don't know it, because CUPS is super reliable. It is easy to use. It's actually, I mean, I remember figuring it out just on my own. I mean, I just kind of learned it. I never had to read a how-to or a tutorial. I just learned it because I'd heard that if you go to this location, you could speak to the back end of your computer, of the thing that drives the printers. And I mean, ever since I discovered it back in the old Mac days, everyone I've ever set up a system for, like their printer, if they invite me over to their house or their apartment, whatever, and they're like, "Oh, help me set this up," which actually happens more often than you'd think. Every time I do that, it's always through Cups, and they never complain. I mean, it's just always like, "Wow, this is working better than a printer's ever." You know, it's always there, it's always available, it's always working. There's no interruption of communication, the printer doesn't get lost track of, or anything like that. You know, everyone's really happy with it. So, learn Cups, get to know it, get to not be afraid of it, and in the end, you will be able to install any printer driver that you possibly need, and like I say, to be fair, you may not really need that many. I want to do some listener feedback, and then I want to talk a little bit about the final topic that I'm going to cover in this show, which you'll have to wait for to hear, and then we'll wrap this exciting season finale up. Lord Drakenblut said in an email, no, actually it was an IM, you can always reach me via instant messenger at notclat2@jabber.org, so if you're on Jabber, or I guess, technically speaking, G-Chat or Google Chat, whatever they call it, you can reach me that way. But anyway, Lord Drakenblut said that, because I was talking about virtualization in a previous episode, and he was talking, or he told me that VirtualBox is free code except for the USB stack and possibly some of the other virtual client, like the actual client itself, some of the nice little touches that they might have on that, like, I don't know. You know, when you go into, like, the preferences of that virtual machine and define maybe some shared storage or, I mean, I don't really know, so I'm just trying to give you an example to give you an idea of what parts we're talking about. Little buttons and switches that you can do to control that virtual machine. Some of that might be proprietary. The USB stack, I guess, is proprietary, and they don't give that away for free or whatever. So if you're going to be doing virtualizing, and you don't want to use Vert Manager, which is what I've been using lately, then you can use VirtualBox, and you can rest assured that it is free code, except for the USB stack, so you won't be able to get a pass-through on USB devices. So if you plug in a USB thumb drive into your physical computer, it's not going to pop up in your virtual machine. That doesn't get passed through. That's not a big deal for me, because I'm running these things on a server that is in a little server closet, and I'm not going to be plugging anything into them that I want the virtual machine to see anyway, so that's not an issue for me. I don't care about some of the client user-friendly features. I'm just not at the point where I need that sort of thing, so that doesn't matter to me. It might matter to you. It just kind of depends. But that was good information to have, for sure. Deep Geek, on a related note, emailed me and said that he was trying out the OpenVZ kernel. OpenVZ is a virtualized kernel that, from what I understand, and boy, does this get confusing, I think that's the one that is sharing the kernel. So instead of running a virtual machine with its own kernel, you're running a virtual machine that is actually using the same kernel that you are using. I don't know exactly what that means. Deep Geek says that it means that you actually need, you know, it's more lightweight. You need fewer resources. You don't need, you know, 8 cores and 16 gigs of RAM and all that other stuff. It's easier on the computer. So that could be interesting, and I might try it. I don't know. I'll have to look into it. I'm new to all this virtualizing stuff, and I'm not that into it. You know, I mean, it's cool that this is something that we can do. It really is very handy, but I have to sort of work myself up to being excited about virtualization. It's just not something that I am passionate about, but it is cool. So check out OpenVZ if you have not yet, and let me know how it goes. Heck, I'd love to hear about it. I don't know if you remember a lot of episodes ago, in fact I think it was the previous season, I was talking a little bit about archiving and seeing how much one thing compressed another thing, and I was talking about 7-zip, which I had, again, just discovered. Turns out someone else had discovered it before, and it turns out that 7-zip, as it clearly states in the man page, didn't preserve Unix permissions, because 7-zip, I guess, had been originally developed for Windows, so that was kind of news to me. Thrice told me about the limitation to 7-zip and how, in order to preserve Unix permissions, you would need to first tar it, and then you could 7-zip it to your heart's delight, but the permissions would have to be kind of locked up inside of that tar, which does, of course, respect Unix permissions. Okay, interesting to know. Well, Thrice comes back again with some archiving kinds of information, and you'll recall a couple episodes ago, I was talking about how to decompress or uncompress unarchive an RPM, and I was using the RPM to CPIO command on Slackware, and that was the kind of the way that I'd figured out how to do it. Turns out there's an even easier way, and this is really cool. There's a tool on your Slackware box that you're sitting in front of right now, and I know you are sitting in front of your Slackware box, and it's called BSDTAR. BSDTAR, as opposed to, for instance, GNUTAR, is a tape archiving tool put out by the BSD folks, and it understands just about every kind of archive you could possibly throw at it. It's really, really cool. I will do a quick man on BSDTAR here. And yeah, it looks like it can extract from tar, PACS, CPIO, ZIP, JAR, AR, ISO 9660 CD-ROM images. It can create tar, PACS, CPIO, AR, and SHAR. It can also apparently do RPM. It can unzip, un-gzip, un-bzip, un-xz. It just does an amazing number of different archive types. It exists on Slackware. I was really, really surprised to find it the other day on a Mac here at work. Apparently they ship with it. And I was about equally as surprised to find that I could not find it anywhere in the Fedora ecosystem. I couldn't find it on the computer itself. I couldn't, or, you know, like on the install of Fedora. I couldn't find it in RPM Fusion. I don't know where it is. So, I mean, I'm sure I could find it if I looked hard enough and get it installed, but in terms of just a quick, you know, yum install BSDTAR, no luck. So you can check if you're on something else, Arch or Debian or whatever, you can check around for BSDTAR, and believe me, it's well worth looking for. It's a really, really nice command. On the surface, I mean, really, really simple usage. You can pretty much fake your way through it with all the stuff that you know from GNUTAR. A lot of it translates fairly well. Now, if you read the man page, they've got a lot of different ways that you can use it, lots of different syntaxes, and I haven't really played around with it as much as I would like to, although I am using it. I'm using it quite often, and it is a really nice little tar program. It's really funny to be at the point in my GNU Linux life where I can just sit around on a lazy afternoon and ponder which tar program has the nicer feature set or has the a more variety of syntax. I mean, if you had told me some time ago that I would be sitting around thinking about, hey, what tar program would I prefer to use right now, I would never believe you. I mean, I was still trying to figure out the sequence of letters for the tar command, you know, tar dash X, what is it, J, V, or does the V go first? Because, you know, back then you don't even know. You know you have to put some assembly of letters behind the word tar, and you can't, and you know you really quickly pick up that you have to end on F, but you have no idea what the X and the Z and the J and the V mean, so you're just like, I've got to do this in the right sequence or it's not going to work. Yeah, so it's really funny, and now I'm thinking, wow, BSDTAR, this is a really nice program. I should start using that, and I'll try it this way this time, and I'll pipe it in from standard out or whatever. You know, it's just, wow, weird stuff. But cool. It's really cool. And again, this kind of goes back to what I was saying, tying it in. See, it's a continuous, coherent episode this way. It goes back to what I'm saying about freedom of choice in free software. Because in free software, I literally have TAR, well, GNU TAR, I should say now, because now I know there are more than one. GNU TAR, BSD TAR, ZIP, of course. I've got GZIP, BZIP, too. And I've got LZMA or XZ, whatever you use, however you get there. You have 7-zip. You have, of course, UNRAR, R-A-R. And there's probably some that... there's Shorten if you're doing some music compression. And there's just, I mean, all kinds of different options. And to some people outside of this, they might look at it and think, you guys are crazy. You don't need that. I've got one thing on my Mac, and it's a zip. And I can get to it this way, and it makes an archive, and that's all I ever need. And it gives you a lot of invisible little metadata that then annoys you when you unzip it on any other program, on any other OS. But anyway, you know, it might look to someone looking in like it was overkill, but I can say very, very comfortably that it's actually not overkill at all. It's really, really great to have all those options. And different times, for different reasons, I actually use most of those. Not UNRAR. I don't actually use... Well, actually, that's not true. I've used UNRAR because there was a sound font that I wanted that was RARD, or whatever. So that was thanks to Thrice for that tip. That was a really, really cool find. Had never heard of it. I would have gone my entire life not knowing that there was such a thing as a BSD TAR versus GNU TAR. So Patrick Archibald, who you'll know from being mentioned on this show before and also on Kernel Panics, stated that he found the audio quality on one of the more recent Kernel Panics to be quite good. And I have to agree, the audio quality of my productions can actually be much higher at this point because I inherited from someone a USB headset. And this headset has a little microphone on it, and it plugs into the USB port of the computer. And it's just, it turns out to be really nice. I didn't purchase it, so I don't know how much it was. It was actually purchased for someone at my job, and they didn't like it. It wasn't what they were looking for. So I kind of just, I took it. I said, here, I can use this. So I took it for myself, and I am using it a lot, actually. And it turns out to be really high quality. So he wanted to know which one that was, and it turns out that it's a Plantronics Audio 626. That's all I know about it. I don't believe it was very expensive. I think it was... I'm going to throw out a number and say no more than $40. It could have been less, for all I know. But yeah, the quality is nice. Now, how much I end up compressing it afterwards, that's a completely different story. I think you will agree. Edward Wood. Now, I don't know if this is the Ed Wood, famous for all of those really splendidly bad movies back in the 50s, or if this is someone who simply shares the name Edward Wood with that person. But Edward Wood was asking me a question about some kind of screen casting thing that I guess his work was doing, and I think it was called Wirecast, maybe? And I don't really know, because I've never seen this, but I guess what it does is it shows you the user's, the presenter's desktop. Like, they're probably giving you sort of a tutorial on how to do something. And then in the corner of the screen, I guess it shows the speaker themselves, so they can... it's picture-in-picture. I don't know why you need to see the presenter, but I guess it's just something human to look at rather than just staring at the presenter's screen the entire time. So he was asking me about this, and I didn't know of any application like this. So eventually, because one of the lead-ins for this question was that he knew that I had been involved with some kind of video project, like a video software project. So he thought I might know how to make something like that happen, which of course is crazy because I don't know anything if it's not down in a tutorial or on someone else's blog or whatever. So eventually he appeared in IRC, and by utter chance, Rowing Golfer was in the IRC channel, and so we all kind of started talking about this issue, and they kind of talked it out, and finally Rowing Golfer had this really simple, probably somewhat obvious if you think about it, you know, in hindsight, you're like, oh, yeah, of course. But, it was a really simple and beautiful solution, and it is simply to do a screen capture while you're running your webcam, which sounds crazy to me. I mean, I'm picturing this on, like, any laptop that I own, and I know it would never work. However, on certain laptops, it would work, and certainly on desktops, a nice powerful desktop, it would work with no problem at all. So the commands basically are just two different commands, and you can find this for yourself on rowinggolfer.blogspot.com. And the commands are, well, first, you would start your webcam, and there are a couple of different applications that look at webcams, right? There's VLC, that you can use VLC to open a capture device, and you point that capture device to whatever your webcam is using. Typically, your webcam is using V4L2, which is video for Linux, or V for Lin, or Vid for Lin, I think is what they say, but it's the second coming of that. Now, there's another one, I think it's called UVC, so you'd have to play around with that, but the point being that you're pointing VLC at the driver of your video device, and usually, more specifically, it's /dev/video0 as what device you want to use as your capture device. So you're driving VLC, and you turn it on, and you can see yourself, you can record, you can take stills, whatever. That's one way. There's another viewer called GUVC View, which basically does the same thing, except that it's centered around the UVC driver, I think. And then there's, of course, MPlayer, which can take video in and put video out. It just doesn't... it's a workhorse. It's MPlayer, for crying out loud. So the command that Rowan Golfer had decided on was MPlayer --cache /128. You could adjust that, of course, for your system. --tv/driver=v4l2. So there you've got the driver being defined. And then he defines the size of the picture, because this is going to be the inset. So he says a : width equals 320, : height equals 240. So he reduces it down to a 320 by 240 frame, which is, you know, fairly common. A lot of webcam cams that you see are basically, they're going to be like 640 by 480, so you're just cutting that in half. And then a --vo /xv /tv:// and that's just saying that your video out is going to use a specific driver and pointing it at a certain device. Not that big of a deal. It's kind of a fairly standard kind of command. I mean, there's some variations on that, but there's a fairly standard command to get an image from, like, a webcam, obviously, on MPlayer. So that's really nice. So that gets a little image of whatever's in front of your webcam, and you can position that wherever you want on your screen so that it's kind of out of the way of your main activities. And then to capture the actual screen, of course, you could use, again, there's a variety of options. There's that one that I actually did used to use a little bit, was was it Avid Demux or something? It was something, AVI Demux or something, or maybe I'm thinking of something else, but it was a nice little capture program. I'm pretty sure, actually, that it wasn't AVI Demux. That's a completely different interface, but it was some little minimalistic GUI to capture the screen. There's, of course, Record My Desktop, which is I've actually never used it. I do have it installed as part of Cadian Live, but never actually used it. And then there's FFmpeg. So just my brain at using MPlayer to capture a video and then FFmpeg to record your desktop, I'm just thinking, wow, that's crazy. But it's completely doable. So it's FFmpeg --f /OSS, so you're defining your sound device, -i/dev-dsp, --f X11 grab, so that's just saying I'm going to grab the X11 display, --s, and you can put in whatever frame size you want here. And there's a list of presets in your FFmpeg man page, and on his blog, Rowan Golfer is using XGA, but you can choose whatever size you want. -r is 15, so that's the frame rate. 15 is not bad. 15 is what you a lot of times actually see online video anyway, so it's not the smoothest of video you'll ever see, but come on, it's a screen grab. --i:0.0, so that's the display that it's actually looking to, so if you've got one monitor, it would be :0.0. And then foo.mp4, whatever you want it to be named, in whatever format you want it to be recorded in. And apparently a couple of people tried this once they had talked about it. I didn't really bother because I don't have a webcam, so that kind of excluded me from the test group. But they said it was working really nicely. So that was just a kind of a really cool way of doing things. And I have to say, Rowan Golfer, after he worked on Auteur video editor, as unfinished as it may have ended up, really, I mean, his work on it was just phenomenal. I mean, the guy's he's a serious programmer, strangely enough. I mean, he's a dentist, but he's a programmer. He knows his stuff, and now he really, I guess, really knows his video stuff, because he can tell you exactly why InPlayer can't stop on an iframe, or whatever, you know. So, yeah, he knows this stuff. Matt wrote me and asked about any way that I might have known about to remove metadata from video files. I don't know why he was asking this. Sounds quite suspicious, I think you'll agree. But he asked, and it turns out it's a pretty simple and direct way of doing that. And I just use FFmpeg. There may be other ways, I don't know. But FFmpeg, of course, does... I don't know what you really call them. I mean, I think of them sort of as ID3 tags, but I don't believe that that's what they technically are. But you can set those in FFmpeg. And I don't remember where the list of this is. I must have found this on a blog or something online, and just kind of jotted them down in my little notebook and just kind of forgot about it, because I looked through the man page and did not see any mention of this, so it's kind of weird. But FFmpeg space dash metadata space title equals, quote, for instance, Klaatu versus the world, end quote, space dash metadata space artist. So you're getting the idea that it's dash metadata and then the value and sum, or what would it be, the key and some value. So artist equals, quote, Klaatu, end quote, space dash metadata space genre equals, quote, sci space fi, end quote, space dash metadata space comment equals, quote, this is a movie about Klaatu versus the world, end quote. So that's all the metadata that we've just defined. Then you want to make sure that you're not destroying the movie or transcoding it or messing it up in any way. So you do a space dash a codec space copy space dash v codec space copy. So you're just saying, don't transcode it, don't change the codecs involved, just make the a codec and the v codec, audio and the video codecs, a copy of whatever they are right now. And then you give it the input file, so space the day the earth stood still dot AVI space the day the earth stood still _ metadata dot AVI or metadata dot AVI, meaning that this is the version with different metadata, and you let it process. I've never done it with a very long movie, like, for instance, The Day the Earth Stood Still. I don't know how long it would take. It would obviously depend on your computer. It's not transcoding, so it shouldn't take that long. It is a bit-for-bit copy, though, and it's adding that metadata to the file. So, obviously, if you wanted to literally just remove metadata, then you would look at the metadata that exists and then overwrite it with an empty value in FFmpeg. David emailed me and said that he really enjoyed my Hacker Public Radio episode on the server client, how to set up a gateway, an internet gateway kind of computer, and a DHCP server, things like that. So he was asking me if I had notes on that process, and I had to unfortunately inform him that I did not have notes written down about the process. And I will tell you why, and it's because, well, first of all, I'll tell you about the series, because if you haven't been keeping up with HPR, you might want to. I did recently a couple of mini-series over on HPR. One of them is a continuation of my Networking Basics mini-series. I started the Networking Basics miniseries back in the 400s, and not the year, but the episode count, episode 400 and, I don't know, 14 or so, and I was just reviewing, like, the protocols and stuff like that, because I was really studying up on those at that time, and that really helped. And then I had to take a break, because I'd kind of gotten to the point where I kind of knew what I was talking about on the protocols, but I didn't really know a whole lot about the actual process, you know, the actual setting up of the server and experiencing how the server talks to the clients and how many clients can be on the server at one time before it starts to feel it, things like that, real-world experience. So I took a break from the Network Basics series, but lately I've had a lot more experience with that, so I decided to go ahead and cover that. So there's a whole series on setting up a server. I go over the Internet Gateway kind of setup, the DHCP server. I review how to set up a DNS, internal DNS server, and probably a couple of other things that I'm just not thinking of right now. So check that out if you've missed that. I also did a mini-series on package building, like Slack building, ports, BSD ports, and RPMs. So those are pretty good episodes as well. And I did a couple of others, but those are the ones that I'm talking about right now, I guess. But more notably, the server. I didn't take notes on this stuff, because if I started to, and it must have been like 2 hours later, I look up from the little notes that I'm supposed to be taking, and I'm writing a book. And I'm, as much as I would love to write a book on this subject, I have two thoughts on that. One is, I'm sure that a book like that somewhere exists, although actually I'm not too convinced about that, but let's pretend like it does. And then second of all, I do not have the time right now to dedicate to writing a book on just kind of getting started on the whole server setting up kind of thing, and all the different things that you can do with that. A good series for that sort of thing, in theory, I the Wiley Press, the such and such Bible. They're big red books. You can't miss them. They're at a bookstore. They're huge. They've got the Fedora and Red Hat Bible. They've got an Ubuntu Bible by Bill von Hagen. Lots of these big books, and they cover a lot. And in one way, they're great reference because they do cover so much. And then in the other way, they cover so much that I don't think that they cover everything completely in depth, you know, so that if you've never set up a server before, I mean, yeah, they might give you the commands of what you're installing, but it doesn't really go through the process and take into account all of the possible things that could go wrong. That's what a book on the subject really should take into consideration. And I think it would be a focused book on, here's how you set up a server, here are some of the things that might happen, and what's supposed to happen, what might not happen, here are some things to try when something doesn't work, that whole thing. But there are sites online, you know, the what is it, Linux Home Networking, I think, is one of them. There's the Linux Documentation Project, you know, there are places all over the internet that will help you set this up. Unfortunately, it seems like there are so many potential setups for a network, and so many different variations on what is possible. I mean, you can hack your way through any kind of setup, you know. I mean, you might be using a laptop as your home server with a PCMCIA additional Ethernet port, or you might be creating a wireless network off of that laptop and serving stuff through that. I mean, it's just, there's so many different ways to do it. Or you might have a real computer, or you might have a desktop with lots of network cards crammed into it. It's impossible to say, and so there are so many variations on it that in order to be complete, you really would have to be very well complete. You'd have to write about it a lot and take into consideration a lot of the different scenarios that people might run into, or otherwise people go to that and it doesn't work and they get frustrated. I'm all for having the documentation, obviously, but I'm not in a position right now to be the one to write that. And I feel like I don't know how to write the notes brief enough to make them helpful, and I don't know how to, and I can't afford the time right now to write it out into the proper documentation that it really should be. And that's why I did the audio for HPR, because that was a good way to get the sort of casual, here's how you do it information out at you, and here are the things that you need to look out for, and now go try it. So it's a good compromise, I think. But yeah, I'm not saying I'm never going to write this stuff down by any means. I want it to be recorded. I want people to learn from the misery that I've experienced. Although I say misery, it's not actually misery. It's actually been a lot of fun. So thanks for the question though, David. And I don't mean to not give you the information that you want. It's just that when I sat down to write it, it was just turning into something a lot more detailed and involved than what I really probably had time for. I'm sure that I've had other listener feedback, and I'm afraid that I've probably lost track of it. That's pretty much status quo for me, unfortunately. I'm never going to have a good system for keeping track of listener feedback and keeping it up to date and making sure that I've covered it. However, as I've often said before, I do respond to email all the time. I talk on IM, I speak on IRC, so if you need to contact me or want to contact me, feel free to do so. I have no problem with that whatsoever. In fact, I actually really enjoy it, so don't hesitate. Okay, final topic for the show. Why I love GNU Linux. Now this is, I guess, in stark contrast to the opening of the show. about what, I guess it was more or less about what angers me about Mac still, although I still don't really know why I care, but concentrating more on the thing that I do use every day, and that I'm happy to use every day, and what keeps making me come back to the computer with this feverish excitement every single day, GNU Linux. Free software. Why do we love it so much? Well, here's why I love it so much. These are actually random things that I kind of notice as I go through the day. When I'm doing something on the computer and it's just working so darn well, and I get that emotional swell in my chest, and I just have to sit back and think, wow, this is unbelievable. This is a computer that is so well programmed that it is just, it's just so great, and why am I feeling this way? And so I'll jot it down. I've got about 5 points. I mean, there are lots of others, but I don't know if I've been able to kind of wrap my mind around them yet. But the one of the ones that I noticed was smart applications. It's really stricken me lately how smart the applications in general on GNU Linux are. They're programmed with a brain behind them. You can tell that someone actually is using them. And I'm not saying this is for every application. I can, right off the top of my head, think of one or two that are programmed decidedly not smart. Like, no one's actually using it. Even the programmer or the developer, they must have never touched it themselves. However, the vast majority of them that I use, at least on an everyday basis, are completely mind-blowingly just intelligent. They just do things well, and they are well thought out. For instance, I mean, this is a simple for instance, but this is one of the ones that literally made me think this. GwenView, which is the KDE image viewer. If you open it, you know, if you're in a folder and it's got an image and you want to look at that image, you click on the image. Of course, it's a single click because you're in KDE and it's very efficient like that. You single click on the image, opens up in GwenView. It doesn't just open that image. It then enqueues all the images in that pictures folder so that you can then continue browsing through the pictures if you decide, oh, that wasn't the one I wanted. I really wanted the one 3 pictures later. Believe it or not, not all image viewers do that. I don't know. Maybe this is old news to you. Maybe this is something that a Windows app that you really like does as well. I don't know. To me, that was a big deal. And even if you open GwenView, it doesn't actually open to just a blank screen. It has a little file navigator right there in the main window. So you're not just staring at a blank, empty GwenView. You've got suddenly all of your files in front of you that you could then navigate to right there from GwenView and choose what you want to look at. This is a big deal to me because I have not seen applications be ready for use so quickly. They don't predict things. They don't anticipate things for me like that. Or if they do, they do it wrong. But GwenView does it exactly right. Another example that comes immediately to mind is Kate. Kate has that great little sidebar down the left-hand side so that you can have multiple documents open at once. A text editor, and you can just click on the document that's in the background on the left-hand side. It's again, just kind of like really, really brilliant. I mean, sure, Emacs has the buffers that you can switch back and forth to, and that's basically the same thing. But on an everyday basis, when you're just kind of clicking on applications that are in your applications menu, or you're showing your friend, here's a cool editor, and something like that comes up, it's a killer feature. I mean, it's really, really smart and efficient and easy to use. Emacs, in itself, I mean, astonishingly smart. I mean, I could go on for hours about Emacs alone. I mean, the way that it's got those little plugins or modules or modes, I guess is what they're called, just so cool. And all the different things that you can make it do, the auto-completion, the XML validation, the screenwriting mode, the org mode, is just incredible. So, yeah, the applications on GNU Linux, for me, at least the ones that I use, they are in themselves killer apps. And I don't even know where to begin to say, oh, I'm going to go head-to-head with this app versus that app on my free OS versus your non-free OS. And I don't even know if I'm interested in trying to draw those equations. It's just all I know is that when I'm using these applications, they don't make me angry. They make me happy. And that's a good place to be when you're computing. Okay, a second point I think of often is efficiency. I don't know if I've ever been, and I think a lot of GNU Linux users are going to say this, I don't know if I've ever been as efficient a computerist as I have ever been on GNU Linux. I remember really, really struggling on my former OS. I'm not going to mention the name because this is a GNU Linux segment. My former OS, I remember trying to get more efficient. I would not use the desktop environment. I would literally kill it at startup and use keyboard-centric environments as often as possible, and I could never really get it to be efficient, and there are lots of reasons for that. But on GNU Linux, it is just really, really efficient. Like I said, KDE single-clicking to open a file. It's the most bizarre thing you can ever think of. I mean, honestly, I when I first saw that in KDE 3, I just thought, wow, who uses their computer this way? How can you want something to open when you simply click it? I mean, don't you have to click it to select it and drag it somewhere? How do you do that? Well, you hold down the control key, or you right-click on it, or you select it with a marquee, or you select it with a little plus sign that appears on your hover over, or your mouse over, whatever. But that's beside the point. Point is that there's efficiency options in KDE, especially, and I know this because I use it, but there's other simple things like vim /documents/whyiloveLinux.txt. And what do you know? It opens vim, and it opens it to the file that you've just defined. I realize that seems really pretty simple, but, I mean, compare this to some substandard GUI text editor where you have to start the application, and then you have to you start typing, and then you have to save it because now it's a new document, so you have to give it a name, right? So you save it, you navigate through the save dialog drop-down box thing, and you tell it what it's going to be called, and you know, and there's all these steps just to create an empty file into which you want to put some text and then name it. You don't have to do that in the terminal. Vim /documents/foo.txt. Suddenly you've got a file called foo.txt. It's living in /documents, and you can edit it from anywhere on your system that you want, and probably even over the network. It makes life so marvelously easy, instead of having to fight the application over whether you really want it to be saved as a plain text document, or would you rather have it as RTF, and you sure you want it in this folder, why don't you put it over here, and just all these ridiculous things that you go through in a GUI, really, but not necessarily every GUI, but bad GUIs, yeah, it can be really, really painful and inefficient. Of course, configurability. Again, I think probably most GNU Linux users are going to agree with me here, but configurability is just insane on GNU Linux. It's everything I would have ever hoped for. I know that certainly me, and I'm pretty sure 330 and Snack Machine B, a couple of people I've talked to, one of the driving forces to find GNU Linux was simply because we wanted a cooler-looking desktop. I could be wrong. I seem to remember 330 saying something like that before, but point being, and you might be one of these people, you know, you knew you wanted a different interface, and you couldn't find a different interface, and then you see all these screenshots of GNU Linux, and they look crazy. You're just like, wow, how do they even get such a spacey-looking command center to their computer? And it's called Fluxbox, and it's got Conky, and it's just so cool, and you try it, and it's incredible. And then you start digging deeper, and you start to realize that you can alias commands. You can just make up your own commands and have them do all manners of different things. You can write your own shell scripts. You're not a programmer by any means. You know I'm not. But even so, you can actually write your own programs. I mean, I've written a whole suite of tools now that will help me format and extract information and print and all the number scenes, all this, and generate title pages, all this stuff for my screenplays. It's crazy. Shortcuts, keyboard shortcuts. I mean, okay, granted, most of my keyboard shortcuts are blatant ripoffs of my former OS's default keyboard shortcuts, but there are those that aren't. You know, there are those keyboard shortcuts, for instance, the super T and super, I guess it's called super, right? The one with a little logo on it. Super K to open up Conqueror. Super T for terminal console. Super X for Xterm. You know, whatever you've got your little keyboard shortcuts defined as, it's a completely different workflow. I have a binary clock. I don't have to use the normal number clock. I can use binary clocks if I want to. I can have a menu bar at the top of my screen if I want. Or I could have it in the top right corner of my screen, as I actually do right now. You can have a taskbar, you don't have to have a taskbar, whatever a taskbar is. I hate taskbars. But anyway, you can get rid of it. You don't have to have it. It's not imposed upon you. You can have a dock if you want, or not. Preferably not. But you could if you wanted to. And every machine you own could be unique, because maybe for whatever reason you want it that way, or maybe you use each machine for a different purpose, or whatever. The point is, it's up to you. I mean, we've all done this before, I'm sure. Someone wants to use Windows, you want them to use GNU Linux, you configure it so that it basically looks and acts like Windows. There's no limit. This is configurability. This is choice, it's options, it's freedom, and it's stuff within just a normal computerist's reach, with a little bit of effort in some cases. In other cases, it's just drop-dead simple. Smart users, that's another observation. Obviously, it's not across the board, but there is a certain culture to Unix, and I think, at least, I mean, I'm fairly new to this culture, but I mean, it's developing in exciting ways, and mostly it's a smart user base. People who come to Unix and Linux, they seem to be typically people who are really seeking to solve a problem, and that's different than someone bailing off of a ship that's sinking. You know, these are people who, at least so far in my experience, who are interested in being problem solvers, and so they find GNU Linux, and they bring that propensity with them. They bring the ability and the interest in solving problems with them. And it doesn't have to be their own problem. It can be someone else's problem. It can be both. But they're troubleshooters. They're people who can look at a problem and say, okay, that's not working for me. What can I do differently to make it work? Or what can I design on my own to make that work? You know, to this crowd, user-friendly or ease of use, it means a simple application with a good man page. It doesn't mean something that looks really pretty and has lots of sparkly little buttons. It might not do anything, but it sure does look good. That's not what they're looking for. I'm sure they don't mind if it looks pretty, but I'm saying that functionality over style, I guess. And I like this crowd. I like this group of people who don't see problems as like roadblocks and things that make them turn off their computer. They're people who look at them as something that they can work around, that they can seek to understand better, and therefore overcome that thing. Because there's going to be problems, obviously, on any computer, on any operating system that you encounter, and it's really it's the burden of the computerist to really figure that out and to get past that. And the smart users do that. They're that kind of person. And I really like that crowd a lot. I mean, when I'm sitting around talking to people about computers, the people who actually know what they're talking about, they're really fun to talk to. And the people who kind of repeat a bunch of marketing nonsense, they're not quite as fun to talk to, really. And finally, the more recent one that I noticed was actually X, interestingly. I don't know if I loved X, or Zorg, I should say, at first. When I first came to Linux, Zorg felt a little bit like a step back to me. It was still using the zorg.conf file, first of all. That felt a little bit weird. And on the hardware that I had, it just didn't feel like graphics were the a number one priority. And part of that is because I think it wasn't a bundled up little set of graphic libraries in the same way that certain other things are. And I'm really thinking about, for instance, and I'll just, you know, like OS X and even Android. Both of those two things have really slick graphic interfaces, because those graphic interfaces are self-contained layers that sit on top of the underlying OS. And I've addressed that in a previous episode a long time ago, wondering if we wanted that, if we wanted that little container sitting neatly on top of our operating system. And I have to argue that no, we really don't. And I don't know if Wayland is going to come down from the sky and save us all. I don't know if that's going to be phenomenally different and improved. I don't know if it's ever going to really take over. I don't know. But the idea that you can have direct control over what you're seeing on your screen via a text-based terminal is not just cool, it is really, really powerful and really, really flexible. And that's one of those things that in GNU Linux, it's just one of those little things that I take for granted quite frequently until I go to an operating system where I don't have that control, and then suddenly I am missing it so much. And the ability to forward X, and the ability to kill things that appear on the screen via virtual console, and just all of that sort of stuff that comes along with Zorg being, I guess, essentially a graphics server, which I guess is really a different concept than being a GUI layer that we've put into a box and placed on top of our system. Very, very, very powerful, and should not be underestimated. Those are probably not all of the greatest things in the world about GNU Linux. In fact, I'm going to venture to say that that's five really sort of unique and minor things. But those are literally the ones that kind of got me all excited and happy at random times throughout the past year, really, as I just sat down and used the operating system that I'm really, really, really fond of. And don't really care to use anything else but that. So hopefully you've enjoyed this exciting season finale. I know I have, and please do continue listening in season 7, because it's going to only get better, I'm sure. Talk to you next time. This has been episode 20 of season 6 of the GNU World Order. My name is Klaatu. You can reach me online at Klaatu at, or not, rather not Klaatu, at jabber.org. Not Klaatu in IRC on the Freenode network in the channel Ogcast Planet. You can email me at Klaatu at hackerpublicradio.org or not Klaatu at member.fsf.org. And you can go to the website for this show at ogcastplanet.org/GNU World Order. Thank you for listening, and I will talk to you next season.
Larger acquaintance with mankind extended their knowledge.